growled Corbeck in amazement.
That's it exactly. How did you know?
Dower shrugged and put his bowl down.
I can't explain. I feel it too. I didn't realize, well, I didn't until you started describing it there. It's not dreams I'm having. Gak, I don't think I'm dreaming much at all, but a feeling. Like I should be doing something.
Fath, murmured Corbeck again.
Are we mad, do you think?
Maybe what we both need is a priest who's a good listener. A confessor.
Maybe a head doctor.
Corbeck dabbed his bread into the broth distractedly. I don't think so. I've nothing to confess. Nothing I haven't told you.
So what do we do?
I don't know. But I know there's no way in Feth I'm getting on that troop ship tonight. He'd stolen a few hours' sleep in a corner of the Western City Infirmary's entrance hall. But as the sun rose and the noise of people coming and going became too much to sleep through, Bryn Milo shouldered his pack and rifle and began the long walk up the Ahmad Road into the center of the Doctrinopolis. Hark had told him to report to Guard Command once he'd escorted the wounded party to safety. He was to present himself and arrange his place on an evacuation ship. The city seemed like a place of madness around him. With the fighting over, the streets had filled up with hurrying crowds, honking motor vehicles, cargo trains hauled by servitors, processions of worshippers, pilgrims, protesters, refugees. The city was seething again, like a Nelmite nest preparing to swarm. Milo remembered the last final hours in Tanith Magna, the same atmosphere of panic and activity. The memories were not pleasant. He decided he wanted to be out of here now, on a troopship and away. There was nothing here now he wanted to stay for, or needed to stay for. A flustered Brevian Centennial on crowd control duties told him that evacuation command had been established in the Royal Treasury, but the roads approaching that edifice were jammed with foot traffic and vehicles. The commotion was unbearable. Transport shuttles shivered the sky as they lifted up over the holy city. A pair of Navy fighters screamed overhead, low and fast. Milo turned and headed for the Scola Medicae, where the Tanith wounded were being cared for. He'd find his own men, maybe Colonel Corbeck, he decided. He'd leave with them.
Brinny boy!
A delighted voice boomed behind him, and Milo was snatched up off his feet in a one-armed bear hug of crushing force.
Brag!
He smiled, turning as he was released.
What are you doing here, Bryn?
Beamed Trooper Bragg.
Long story, said Milo.
How's the arm there?
Bragg glanced contemptuously at his heavily bandaged right shoulder.
Fixing up. Fething medics refused to let me join the honor guard. Said it was a safe ticket out for me, Fetham. That's not bad. I could have still fought.
Milo gestured to the busy hallway of the Scola Medicae Hagius they stood in.
Anyone else around?
A few. Most of them in a bad way. Colonel's here somewhere, but I haven't seen him. I was in a bed next to Derren. He's on the mend and cussing his luck, too.
I'm going to try and find the Colonel. What ward are you in?
South 6.
I'll come and find you in a bit.
You'd better.
Milo pushed on through the hectic hallway, through the smells of blood and disinfectant, the hurrying figures, the rattling carts. He passed several doors that opened onto long red-painted wards, lined with critically injured guardsmen in rows of cots. Some were ghosts, men he recognized. All were too far gone from pain and damage to register him. After asking questions of several orderlies and servitors, he found his way to Dorden's suite of offices on the third floor. As he approached, he could hear the shouting coming from inside down the length of the corridor.
"Don't just get up and walk off when you feel like it. For the Emperor's sake, you're hurt. That won't heal if you put a strain on it."
An answering mumble.
"I will not calm down. The health of the regimental wounded is my business. Mine. You wouldn't disobey Gaunt's orders. Why the Feth do you think you can disobey mine?"
Milo walked into the office. Corbeck was sitting on an examination couch facing the door, and his eyes opened wide when he saw Milo. Dorden, shaking with rage, stood facing Corbeck and turned sharply when he read Corbeck's expression.
"Milo?"
Corbeck leapt up. "What's happened? The honor guard? What the Feth's happened?"
"There was an ambush in the road last night. We took a few injured. Some bad enough, Sergeant Kurth wanted them brought back here. Commissar Hark volunteered me to ride shotgun. We got back here at dawn."
"And you meant to return?" Milo shook his head. "I'd never catch up with them now, Colonel.
My orders are to join the evacuation now I'm here.
How are they doing? Apart from the ambush, I mean.
Not so bad. They should have made it to the overnight stop at Mukret.
Did we lose many in the attack?
Dorden asked softly. His anger seemed to have dulled.
43 dead, 15 of them ghosts, 6 ghosts amongst the injured I brought back.
Sounds bad, Milo.
It was quick and nasty.
You can show me on the map where it happened,
Corbeck told him.
Why? Snapped Dorden. I've told you already. You're not going anywhere, except to the landing fields this evening. Forget the rest, Com. I mean it. I have seniority in this, and Lugo would have my fething head. Forget it.
There was a loaded pause.
Forget what?
Milo dared to ask.
Don't get him started, Dorden roared.
The boy's just asking, Doc,
Corbeck countered.
You want to know, Milo, do you?
Dorden was livid.
Our beloved colonel here has this idea. No, let me start at the beginning. Our beloved colonel here decides he knows doctoring better than me, and so gets himself out of bed against my orders this morning. Goes wandering around the fething city. We didn't even know where he was. Then he shows up again without so much as a by your leave, and tell me he's thinking of heading up into the mountains.
Into the mountains?
That's right. He's got it into his thick head that there's something important he's got to do. Something gaunt, an armor unit, and nigh on 3,000 troopers can't manage without his help.
Be fair, I didn't quite say that, Dog. Dorden was too busy ranting at the rather stunned Milo.
He wants to break orders. My orders. The Lord General's orders. In a way, Gaunt's own orders. He's going to ignore the instructions to evacuate tonight, and go chasing up into the sacred hills after Gaunt, on his own. Because he has a hunch.
Not on my own,
Corbeck growled in a whisper.
Oh, don't tell me. You've persuaded some other fools to go along with you. Who? Who, Colonel? I'll have them chained to their thething beds.
Then I won't tell you who, will I?
Corbeck yelled.
A hunch?
Milo asked, quietly.
Yeah, said Corbeck. Like one of my hunches.
Spare us, one of Colonel Corbeck's famous battle itches.
Corbeck wheeled round at Dorden, and for a moment Milo was afraid he was going to throw a punch, and even more afraid that the medic was going to throw one back.
Since when have my tactical itches proved wrong, eh?
Fifth and when?
Dorden looked away.
But no, it's not like that. Not an itch, not really. Or it's like the granddaddy of all battle itches. It's more like a feeling.
That's all right, then. A fifth damned feeling,
said Dorden sarcastically.
More like a calling, then, bellowed Corbeck. Like the biggest, strongest calling I've ever had in my life. Pulling at me. Demanding of me. Like if I've got the wit to respond, the balls to respond, I'll be doing the most important thing I could ever do.
Dorden snorted. There was a long, painfully heavy pause.
Colm, it's my job to look after the men. More than that, it's my pleasure to look after them. I don't need orders.
Dorden sat down behind his desk and fiddled with a sheaf of scripts, not making eye contact with either of the others.
I came into Old Town with Collier. Broke orders to do it, because I thought we might get you out alive.
And you did, Doc. And Feth knows I owe you and the boys that one.
Dorden nodded.
But I can't sanction this. You, and anyone else you may have talked to, you all need to be at the muster point for evacuation at 6 tonight. No exceptions.
It's an order from the office of the Lord General himself.
Any dissenters, any absentees, will be considered as having deserted, and will suffer the full consequences.
He looked up at Corbeck.
Don't do this to me, Colm.
I won't. They ask you. You don't know a thing. I'd have liked you to join me, Doc. Really, I would. But I won't ask that of you. I understand the impossible position that it puts you in. But what I feel isn't wrong.
Corbeck, please.
The last few nights, my dad's been in my dreams. Not just a memory, I mean. Really him. Bringing me a message.
What sort of message? Asked Milo.
All he says is the same thing, over and over. He's in his machine shop, back in Price County, working the lathe there. I come in, and he looks up, and he says, Sabbat Martyr. Just that.
I know what's going on, said Dorden. I feel it myself.
It's perfectly natural.
We both know this is Gaunt's last show. That Lugo's got his balls in a vice. And that means, let's face it, the end for the ghosts. We all want to be there with Gaunt this last time. The honor guard, the last duty. It doesn't feel right to be missing it. We'd do anything. We'd think of any excuse to get out there after him. Even subconsciously, our minds are trying to magic up ways to make it happen.
It's not that, Doc.
I think it is.
Well, then maybe it is. Maybe it is my subconscious trying to jinx up an excuse. And maybe that's good enough for me. Gaunt's last show, Doc. You said it yourself. They can court-martial me, but I won't miss that. Not for anything.
Corbett glanced at the silent Milo, patted him on the arm, and limped out of the office.
Can you talk some sense into him, do you think?
Dorden asked Milo.
From what I've just heard, I doubt it.
In all candor, sir, I doubt I want to. Dorden nodded.
Try, for my sake. If Corbeck's not at the muster point tonight, I won't sell him out. But I can't protect him.
Corbeck was in his little room, sorting his pack on the unmade bed. Milo knocked at the half-open door.
You coming with me? I shouldn't ask. I won't be offended if you say no.
What's your plan? Corbeck half-shrugged.
Faith do I know. Dara's with me. He feels the same. Really, he feels the same. You know?
Milo said nothing. He didn't know.
Dara's seeing if he can find any others crazy enough to come. We'll need able men. It won't be an easy ride.
It'll be hell. A small unit, moving west. The Infardi are everywhere.
They didn't think twice about hitting a target the size of the task force.
We could so do with a scout. Local knowledge, maybe. I don't know.
Assuming we make it through, all the way to the Shrinehold, what then?
Pfft me. I hope by then my dad will have told me more. Or maybe Dower will have figured it out. Or it'll be obvious.
It sure isn't obvious now, sir.
Whatever it is, if Gaunt and the task force can't do it, how could we hope to? Maybe they don't know. Maybe they need to do something else.
Corbeck turned and smiled at Milo.
You realize you've been saying we, don't you?
I guess I have.
Good lad. It wouldn't be the same without you.
Well, faith bless my good soul, said Colm Corbeck.
He was so touched by the sight before him, he felt he might cry.
Did y'all? I mean, are y'all...
Bragg got up from the base of the pillar he was sitting against and stuck out his hand.
We're all as crazy as you, Chief,
he smiled. Corbeck gripped his meaty paw hard.
Dower and Milo asked around. We're the only takers. I hope we'll do. You'll do me fine.
They stood in the shadows of the Munitorium warehouse on Pavane Street, off the main thoroughfare, out of sight. The contents of the warehouse had been evacuated that morning. It had been arranged as the rendezvous point. It was now close to 6 o'clock. Somewhere a troop ship was waiting for them. Somewhere their names were being flagged on the commissariat discipline lists. Corbeck moved down the line as the assembled troopers got up to greet him.
Darren, how's the chest?
Don't expect me to run anywhere,
smiled Trooper Darren. There was no sign of injury about him, but his arms moved stiffly. Corbeck knew a whole lot of suturing and bandages lay under his black Tanith field jacket.
Nessa, my girl.
She threw him a salute, her long lass resting against her hip. Ready to move out, Colonel, sir, she signed.
Trooper Vanderfeld, sir,
said the next in line. Corbeck grinned at the pale, slightly out of condition Vergastite.
I know who you are, Vanderfeld. Good to see you.
You said you needed local knowledge,
Milo said as Corbeck reached him.
This is Sanyan. She's a Shuli, one of the student body.
Miss, Corbeck saluted her. Sanyan looked up at Corbeck and appraised him frankly.
Trooper Milo described your mission as almost spiritual, Colonel. I would probably lose my privileges and status for absconding with you.
We're absconding now, are we?
The troopers around them laughed.
The saint herself is in your mind, Colonel. I can see that much. I have made my choice. If I can help by coming with you, I am happy to do it.
It won't be easy, Miss Sanyan. I hope Milo's told you that much.
Sanyan, I am just Sanyan.
or Isholi Senyon, if you prefer to be formal. And yes, Milo has explained the danger. I feel it will be an education.
Safer ways of getting an education, Derrin began. Life itself is the education for the Isholi, said Milo, smartly. Senyon smiled.
I think Milo has been paying too much attention to me.
Well, I can see why, said Corbeck, putting on the charm. You're welcome here with us. Do you know much about the land west of here?
I was raised in Bavnaga, and the western territories of the Sacred Hills and the Pilgrim's Way are fundamental knowledge for any Isholi.
Well, didn't we just win the top prize? Grinned Corbeck. So, he said, turning to face the six of them, I guess we wait for Dower. He's in charge of transport. The group broke up into idle chatter for a minute or two. Suddenly, they all heard the clatter of tracks in the street outside. All of them froze, snatching up weapons, expecting the worst.
What do you see?
Vamberfeld hissed to Bragg.
It's the commissariat, isn't it? Said Derrin. They're fettin' onto us.
An ancient, battered chimera rumbled into the warehouse. Its turbines coughed and rasped as they shut down. It was the oldest and worst-kept piece of munitorium armor Milo had ever seen, and that included the junk piles that had been given to the Honor Guard convoy. The back hatch opened, and Dower edged out as gracefully as his aching wound allowed.
"Best I could do," he said. "It was one from the motor pool they're going to abandon in the evacuation."
"Faith," said Corbeck, walking around the dirty green hulk. "But it goes, right?"
"It goes for now," replied Dower. "What do you want, Corbeck? Miracles?"
A second man climbed out of the chimera. He was a tall, blonde, freckled individual in Pardus uniform. His head was bandaged.
"This is Sergeant Greer, Pardus 8th Mobile Flak Company. I knew none of us could handle this beast, so I co-opted a driver. Greer here kind of owes me."
"That's what he says," Greer said sulkily. "I'm just along for the ride."
"Where'd you get the hurt?" Corbeck asked him. Greer touched his bandage.
"Glancing shot. During the action to take the census hall a few days back."
Corbeck nodded. The same action Dower had been hurt in. He shook Greer's hand.
"Welcome to the wounded," he said.
At around 6:30, the names of troopers Derrin, Vamberfeld, Nessa and Bragg, and of Captain Dower and Colonel Corbeck, were noted in the log of the evacuation office as overdue. The lift shuttle left without them. At a muster point further east across the Doctrinopolis, the Pardus chief surgeon noted the absence of Driver Sergeant Greer. Both reports were sent to evacuation command and entered into the night log. The officer of the watch wasn't unduly taxed by this. He had over 300 names on his list of absentees by then, and it was growing with each passing shuttle call. There were many reasons for missed muster: badly relayed orders, confusion as to the correct muster point, delays because of traffic in the Holy City, unlogged deaths from the guard infirmaries. Indeed, some names on the evacuation lists were of troopers who had died in the liberation fight and as yet lay undiscovered and unidentified in the rubble. Some, a very few, were deserters. Such names were passed to the discipline officers and the Lord General's staff. The officer of the watch passed these latest names on. It was unusual for senior officers like a colonel to fail to report. By 8:00, the list had dropped onto the desk of Commissar Heitus, who was away at dinner. His aide passed it to the punishment detail, who by 9:30 had sent a 4-man team led by a commissar cadet down to the Scolum Medicae Hagius to investigate. A report was copied to Lord General Lugo's staff, where it was read by a senior adjutant shortly before midnight. He immediately voxed the punishment detail and was told by the commissar cadet that no trace of the missing personnel could be found at the Scolum Medicae. At 1:00 a.m, a warrant was issued for the arrest of Colonel Colm Corbeck of the Tanith First and Only, along with 6 of his men. No one thought or knew to tally this with the warrant out for Sergeant Driver Denick Greer of the Pardus 8th, or the theft report of a Class Gamma transport chimera from the Munitorium motor pool. By then, Corbeck's chimera was long gone, heading west down the Temberong Road, 5 hours out from the city perimeter, thundering into the night. It had made one stop, in the half-empty, war-torn suburb streets just short of the Pilgrim Gate. That had been around 7 at night, with deep, starless dusk falling. At the helm, Greer had seen a figure in the road ahead. waving at them. Corbeck had popped the turret hatch and looked out, almost immediately calling down at Greer to pull over. Corbeck had dropped down from the waiting Chimera, his boots kissing the road dust, and had walked to meet the figure face to face.
"Sabbat mater,"
Dorden had said, tears in his eyes.
"My boy told me to. Don't think for a minute you're going without me."
Chapter 9. Approaching Bavnaga. If the road is easy, the destination is worthless. Saint Sabbat, Proverbs. From Mukret, the highway ran due west to the Nuzera crossing, where the Holy River twisted across it. North of the crossing, the river's course snaked up to the headwaters in the hills, 150 kilometers away. The second day of the mission dawned soft and bright, with the lowland plains of the river valley dressed in thick white fogs. The scout spearhead under McColl left Mukret through the early fogs, travelling at a moderate rate because of the reduced visibility. Gaunt and Cleopas had assembled 3 scout salamanders carrying 12 ghost troopers between them, 2 conqueror tanks and 1 of the 2 destroyer tank hunters in the Pardus complement. The main task force set out from Mukret an hour behind them. Gaunt's intention was to reach the farming community of Bavnaga by the second night. This meant a run of nearly 95 kilometers on decent roads. But already the mists were slowing their progress. At Bavnaga, so intelligence reported, they could refuel for the later stages of the journey. Bavnaga was the last settlement of appreciable size on the northwest spur of the highway. It marked the end of the arable lowlands and the start of the rainwood districts that dress the climbing edges of the sacred hills. From Bavnaga, the going would become a lot tougher. Ayatani Zwail had agreed to accompany the main task force, and rode with Gaunt in his command salamander at the Colonel Commissar's personal invitation. He seemed intrigued by the Imperial mission. No one had told him of the intended destination, but he clearly had ideas of his own, and once they took the northwest fork at Limata, there would be no disguising where they were heading. "How long do these fogs last, Father?" Gaunt asked him as the convoy ran through the pale, smoke-like mists. It was bright, and the fogs glowed with the sunlight beyond, but they could see only a few 12 meters ahead of themselves. The sounds of the convoy engines, amplified, were thrown back on them by the heavy vapor. Zwail toyed with his long, white beard.
"In this part of the season, sometimes until noon. These, I think, are lighter. They will lift, and when they lift, they go suddenly."
"You're not much like the other Ayatani I've met here, if you'll forgive me saying so. They all seem tied to a particular shrine and places of worship." Zwail chuckled.
"They are Tempelum Ayatani, devoted to their shrine places. I am Imhava Ayatani, which means roving priest. Our order celebrates the saint by worshipping the roots of her journeys."
"Her journeys here?"
"Yes, and beyond. Some of my kind are up there."
He pointed a gnarled finger at the sky, and Gaunt realized he meant space itself. Space beyond Hagia.
"They travel the stars."
"Indeed. They pace out the route of her great crusade, her war pilgrimage to Harkalon, her wide circuit of return. It can take a lifetime, longer than a lifetime. Few make the entire circuit and return to Hagia."
"Especially in these times, I imagine."
Zwail nodded thoughtfully.
"The return of the arch-enemy to the Sabbat worlds has made such roving a more lethal undertaking."
"But you are content to make your holy journeys here?"
Zwail smiled his broad, gap-toothed smile.
"These days, yes. But in my youth I walked her path in the stars, to Fengold, before Hagia called me back."
Gaunt was a little surprised.
"You've travelled off this world?"
"We're not all parochial little peasants, Colonel Commissar Gaunt. I've seen my share of the stars and other worlds. A few wonders on the way. Nothing I'd care to stay for. Space is overrated."
"I tend to find that, too." Gaunt grinned.
"The main purpose of the Imhava Ayatani is to retread the roots of the saint and offer assistance to the believers and pilgrims we find making their way. Guardians of the route.
It is, I think, small-minded for a priest to stay at a shrine or temple to offer aid to the pilgrims who arrive. The journey is the hardest part. It is on the journey that most would have need of a priest.
That's why you agreed to come with us, isn't it?
I came because you asked. Politely, I might add. But you're right. You are pilgrims, after all.
I wouldn't call us pilgrims, quite.
I would. With devotion and resolve, you are following one of the saint's paths. You are going to the shrinehold, after all.
I never said...
No, you didn't. But pilgrims usually travel east.
He gestured behind them in the vague direction of the Doctrinopolis.
There's only one reason for heading this way.
The Vox squawked, and Gaunt slid down in the driving well to answer it. McColl was checking in. The spearhead had just forded the Holy River at Nuzera and was making good speed to Limata.
The fogs, McColl reported, were beginning to lift.
When Gaunt resumed his seat, he found Zweil looking through his ragged copy of Sabbat's Gospel.
A well-thumbed book,
said Zweil, making no attempt to set it aside.
Always a good sign. I never trust a pilgrim with a clean and pristine copy. The texts you've marked are interesting. You can tell much of a man's character by what he chooses to read.
What can you tell about me?
You are burdened. Hence the numerous annotations in the devotional creeds, and burdened by responsibility, and the demands of office in particular. These three selections in the epistles of duty show that you seek answers, or perhaps ways of fighting internal demons. That is plain from the number of paper strips you've used to mark the pages of the doctrines and revelations. You appreciate battle and courage, the annals of war here, and you are sentimental when it comes to fine devotional poetry.
He held the book out open to show the Psalms of Sabbat.
Very good, said Gaunt.
You smile, Colonel Commissar Gaunt.
I am an Imperial commander leading a task force of war on a mission. You could have surmised all that about me without even looking at the bookmarks.
I did,
laughed Zweil. He carefully closed the Gospel and handed it back to Gaunt.
If I might say, Colonel Commissar, the Gospel of our saint does contain answers, but the answers are often not literal ones. Simply reading the book from cover to cover will not reveal them. One has to feel, to look around the bare meanings of the words.
I studied textual interpretation at Scholam Progenium.
Oh, but I'm sure you did. And from that I'm sure you can tell me that when the saint talks of the flower incarnadine, she means battle, and when she refers to the fast-flowing river of pure water, she means true human faith. What I mean to say is the lessons of Saint Sabbat are oblique mysteries, to be unlocked by experience and innate belief. I'm not sure you have those. The answers you seek would have come to you by now, if you had.
I see.
I meant no disrespect. There are high Ayatani in the holy city who do no more than read and re-read this work and fancy themselves enlightened.
Gaunt didn't reply. He looked out of the rocking tank and saw how the fog was beginning to burn off with remarkable haste. Already the tree lines at the river were becoming visible.
Then how do I begin?
Gaunt asked darkly.
For, truth be told, Father, I have need of answers. Now, more than ever before.
I can't help you there. Except to say, start with yourself. It is a journey you must make, standing still. I told you you were a pilgrim.
Half an hour later, they reached the crossing at Nuzera. The highway came down to a wide, shallow pan of shingle that broke the fast-flowing water in a broad fording place. Groves of gillum trees clustered at either bank, and hundreds of forkbills broke upwards into the sky in an explosive fan at the sound of the motors, their wings beating the air with the sound of ornithopter gunships. A lone peasant with an ancient cow chelan on a pull rein waved them past. One by one, the vehicles of the honor guard ploughed over the ford, spraying up water so hard and high that rainbows marked their wake. Limata was another dead town. McCall's spearhead reached it just before 11:30. The fogs had vanished. The sun was climbing and the air was still. This day was going to be even hotter than the last. The baking roofs of Limata lay ahead, dusty and forlorn, their tiles bright pink in the sunlight. No breeze, no sounds, no telltale fingers of cook-fire smoke rising above the village. Here, the Temburong Road divided, one spur heading southwest towards Hylophon and Temburong itself. The other broke northwest into the highlands and the streaming tracks of the rainwoods. 40+ kilometers in that direction lay Bavnaga. "Slow to steady," McCall snapped into his vox. "Troopers, arm. Load main weapons. Let's crawl in." Captain Cirrus, commanding the Pardus elements, voxed in immediately from his conqueror.
"Allow us, Tenneth. We'll drive them down."
"Negative. Full stop." The vehicles came to a halt 600 meters short of the town perimeter. The ghosts dismounted from the salamanders. Idling engines rumbled in the hot, dry air.
"What's the delay?"
Cyrus snapped over the vox. "Stand by," replied McCall. He glanced around at Trooper Domor, one of the disembarked troopers.
"You sure?"
"Sure as they call me Shoggy,"
Domor nodded, carefully using a felt cloth to wipe dust grit from the lenses of his augmetic eyes.
"You can see the way the road surface there is broken and repacked."
Most eyes couldn't, but McCall's were sharper than any in the regiment, and Domor's field specialization was in landmines.
"Want me to sweep?"
"Might be an idea.
Unship your kit, but don't advance until I see." Domor went over to his salamander with troopers Kaaba and Uril to unpack the sweeper sets. McCall fanned fire teams out into the acetus groves on either side of the roadway, McVenner to the left and Bonin to the right, each with 3 men. Within seconds of entering the dappled shadows of the fruit trees, the men were invisible, their stealth cloaks absorbing the patterns around them.
"What's the delay?"
asked Captain Cyrus from behind. McCall turned. Cyrus had dismounted from his waiting conqueror, the Wrath of Padua, and had come forward to see for himself. He was a robust man in his early 50s, with the characteristic olive skin and beaked nose of the Pardus. He seemed a little gung-ho to McCall, and the scout sergeant had been disappointed when Cleopas had appointed him to McCall's spearhead company.
"We've got road mines in a tight field there, and maybe beyond,"
McCall gestured, "and the place is too quiet for my liking."
"Tactics?"
Cyrus asked, briefly. "Send my sweepers forward to clear the road for you and infiltrate the village from the sides with my troops." Cyrus nodded sagely.
"I could tell you're infantry, sergeant. Bloody good at it too, so I hear. But you haven't got the armor experience. You want that place taken. My Wrath can take it."
McCall's heart sank.
"How?"
"That's what the Adeptus Mechanicus made dozer blades for. Give the word and I'll show you how the Pardus work."
McCall turned away and walked back to his salamander. This wasn't his approach to recon patrols. He certainly didn't want the Pardus heavies lighting up the hill for all to see with their heavy guns. He could take Limata his way by stealth, he was sure, but Gaunt had urged him to cooperate with the armor allies. He reached into the salamander and pulled out the long-gain vox mic.
"Recon spear to one."
"One, go ahead."
"We've got a possible obstruction here at Limata. Certainly a minefield. Request permission for Captain Cyrus to go in armored and loud."
"Is it necessary?"
"You said to play nice."
"So I did. Permission granted."
McCall hung up the mic and called to Domor's group.
"Pack it away. It's the Pardus's turn."
Griping, they began to disassemble the sweeper brooms.
"Captain?"
McCall looked over to Cyrus.
"It's all yours."
Cyrus looked immensely pleased. He ran back to his revving tank. At his urging, riding high in the open hatch of his turret, the two conquerors clanked past the waiting salamanders and headed down the highway. The grim destroyer waited behind them, turbines barely murmuring. The two battle tanks lowered their hefty dozer blades as they came up on the mined area and dug in, driving forward. Captain Cyrus's mine clearance methods were as brutal as they were deafening. The massive dozer blades ploughed the hard pan of the road and kicked up the buried munitions, which triggered and detonated before them. Clouds of flame and debris swirled up around the advancing tanks. If the mines had been triggered under a passing vehicle, they would have crippled or destroyed it, but churned out like the seeds of a water apple or flints turned up by a farrier's plough, They exploded harmlessly, barely scorching the thrusting dozer blades. It was an impressive display, McColl had to admit. Smoke and dust drifted back down the road over McColl and the waiting salamanders. McColl shielded his eyes and purposely kept his off-road fire teams in position. In less than 6 minutes, the Wrath of Padua and its sister tank, Lion of Padua, were rolling into Limata, the road buckled and burning behind them. McColl got up on the fender of his salamander and ordered all three light tanks to move forward after them. He looked round. The destroyer had disappeared.
What, the Feth?
How did something that big and heavy and ugly disappear?
Recon spear command to destroyer. Where the Feth are you?
Destroyer to command. Sorry to startle you. Standard regimental deployment. I pulled off-road to lie low. Frontal assaults are the Conqueror's job, and Cyrus knows what he's doing.
Read that, destroyer.
McColl, who was generally inexperienced when it came to tank warfare, had already noted the clear differences between the Conqueror battle tanks and the low-bodied destroyers. Where the Conquerors were high and proud, stately almost, with their massive gun turrets, the destroyers were long-hulled and sleek, their one primary weapon not turret-mounted, but fixed out forward from their humped backs. The destroyers were predators, tank hunters, armed with a single, colossal laser cannon. They were, it seemed to McColl, the tank equivalent of an infantry sniper. Accurate, cunning, hard-hitting, stealthy. The destroyer appointed to the recon spear was called the Grey Venger. Its commander was a Captain Le Guin. McColl had never seen Le Guin face to face. He just knew him by his tank. Through the rising pall of smoke, McColl saw the Conquerors were in the village now. They were kicking up dust. Abrupt small arms fire rained against their armored bodies from the left. The Wrath of Padua traversed its turret and blew a house apart with a single shell. Its partner began shelling the right flank of the town's main drag. Stilt houses disintegrated or combusted. The sponson-mounted flamers on both Conquerors rippled through the close-packed buildings and turned them into torch ruins. Captain Cyrus's whoops of triumph came over the vox. McColl could see him in his turret, supporting his main weapon's blasts with rakes from the pintle mount.
"That's just showing off," Domo said beside him.
"Tank boys," murmured Caoba. "Always wanted to show who's boss."
Advancing, they found the bloody, burned remnants of maybe 3 dozen Infardi in the ruins Cyrus had flattened. Limata was taken. McColl signaled the news to Gaunt and advanced the spearhead, bringing his fire teams in and reforming the force with the salamanders at the front. The destroyer trundled out of hiding and joined the back of the column.
"Next up, Bavnaga,"
Cyrus warbled enthusiastically from his conqueror.
"Move out,"
ordered McColl. Well over a day behind them, Korbeck's thrown-together team rolled past the site of the ambush, skirting around the wrecks of the salamanders and the chimera that the task force's Trojans had pushed to the roadside verges. Korbeck called a halt. The chimera's turbine was overheating anyway, and the troopers dismounted for a rest. Korbeck, Derin, and Bragg wandered over to the roadside where a plot of dark earth and rows of fresh-cut stakes marked the graves of the fallen.
"One we missed," said Derin.
Korbeck nodded. This sight marked the first ghost's action that he hadn't been a part of. Not properly. All the way from Tanith he'd come, to be with his men. Here they'd fought and died, while he had been lying in his bed miles away. His chest hurt. He swallowed a couple more pain pills with a swig of tepid water from his flask. Greer had dismounted from the Chimera on the road and had yanked back its side cowlings to vent greasy black smoke. He reached in with a wrench, trying to soothe its ailing systems. Milo thought he'd talked to Sanyan, but the Isholi had wandered down to the water's edge with Nessa. It looked like the Vergastite girl was teaching the student the rudiments of sign language.
"She likes to learn, doesn't she?"
Milo looked round and met Captain Dower's smile.
"Yes, sir."
"I'm glad you found her, Bryn. I don't think we'd last long without a decent guide."
Milo sat himself down on a roadside stump, and Dower sat next to him, cautiously nursing his wounded body down.
"What do you know, sir?"
Milo asked.
"About what?"
"About this mission.
Korbeck said you knew as much as him, that you, felt the same way."
"I can't offer you an explanation, if that's what you're asking for. I just have this urge in my head."
"I see."
"No, you don't. And I know you don't. And I love you like a brother for daring to come this far in such ignorance."
"I trust the Colonel."
"So do I."
Have you not had dreams? Visions?
No, sir. All I have is my loyalty to Korbeck.
To you. To Gaunt. To the God Emperor of mankind.
The Emperor protects.
Dawa put in dutifully.
That's all.
Loyalty? To the ghosts? That's all I know. For now, that's all I need.
But you delivered to us our guide.
A calm, frail voice said suddenly.
I did what?
Dawa paused and blinked.
What?
He asked Milo, who was looking at him mistrustfully.
You said, but you delivered to us our guide just then.
Your voice was strange.
Did I? Was it?
Yes, sir.
I meant Sanyan. I know you did, but that was a pretty odd way of saying it.
I don't remember. Gak, I don't remember saying that at all.
Milo looked at Dawa dubiously. With all respect, Captain, you're weirding me out here.
Milo, I think I'm weirding myself out, he said.
Doc?
Korbeck?
They stood in the groves overlooking the burial place. It was the first chance they'd got to talk alone since leaving the Doctrinopolis.
Your son, you say?
Mikal. My son?
In your dreams?
For days now. I think it started when I was looking for you in Old Town, you old bastard.
You hadn't dreamt of Mikal before. Mikal Dorden had died on Bagast. He had been the only ghost to escape the destruction of Tanith with a blood relative alive. Trooper Mikal Dorden, Chief Medic Tolin Dorden. Ghosts together, father and son, until Vervenhive and Vervair Gate.
Of course, every night, but not like that. This was like Mikal wanted me to know something, to be somewhere. All he said was Sabbat Martyr. When you said the words too, I realized.
That's going to be hard, said Korbeck, softly, getting up there. He pointed up towards the sacred hills, which lingered distantly, partly obscured by the smudge of a rainstorm over the woods.
I'm ready, Colm,
Dorden smiled.
I think the others are too, but keep your eye on Trooper Vamberfeld. His first taste of combat hasn't gone down well. Shock trauma. He may get past it naturally, but some don't. I don't think he should be here.
And truth, none of us should. I took what I could get, but point taken. I'll be watching him.
I respect you.
I'm sure you do, buddy,
said Greer, nursing the old Chimera's engines back to health.
But I do. I respect you,
repeated Trooper Vamberfeld.
And why's that?
Asked Greer offhand, as he unclamped a fuel pipe.
To join this pilgrimage. It's so holy. So, so holy.
Oh, it's so holy, sure enough, growled Greer.
Did the spirit of the saint speak to you?
Vamberfeld asked. Greer looked round at him with a cynical eyebrow cocked.
Did she speak to you?
Of course she did. She was triumphant and sublime.
That's great. Right now, I've got an engine to fix.
The saint will guide your work.
Will she crap? The moment Saint Sabbat manifests here and helps me flush out the intercooler, then I'll believe.
Vamberfeld looked a little crestfallen.
Then why do you come?
The gold, naturally,
Greer said, overstressing each word as one would to a child.
What gold?
The gold! In the mountains! Dad must have told you about it. No. Only reason I'm here.
The gold ingots. My kind of come on.
But there is no treasure. Nothing physical. Just faith and love.
Whatever you reckon.
The captain wouldn't lie. Of course he wouldn't. He loves us all.
Of course he does. Now, if you'll excuse me.
Vamberfeld nodded and walked away obediently. Greer shook his head to himself and returned to work. He didn't get these Tanith. Too intense for his liking. And ever since he'd arrived on Hagia, he'd heard men rambling on and on about faith and miracles. So it was a shrine world. So what? Greer didn't hold with that sort of stuff much. You lived, you died, end of story. Sometimes you got lucky and lived well. Sometimes you got unlucky and died badly. God and saints and freaking angels and stuff was the sort of nonsense men filled their heads with when bad luck came calling. He wiped his hands on a rag and cinched the hose clamp tighter.
This mob of losers was a crazy lot. The colonel and the doctor and that complete sad case Vamberfeld were mooning on about visions and saints, clearly all out of their heads. The deaf girl he didn't get. The big guy was an idiot. The boy Milo was way too up himself, and only here because he had the hots for that local girl, who was incidentally a nut job in Greer's humble opinion. Derren was the only one who seemed remotely okay. Greer was sure that was because Derren was along for the gold, too. Dower must have persuaded the rest of the lunatics to sign on by buying into their saint fixations. Dower was a hard case. He looked all clean-cut and stalwart, the very model of a young, well-bred officer, but under the surface ticked the heart of a conniving bastard. Greer knew his type. Greer hadn't liked Dower since the moment they'd met in the prayer yard. Dressing him down in front of his men like that, Greer had only ended up wounded because he'd been going all out in the fight to prove his mettle and win back his rep. But Dower had needed a driver, and he'd cut Greer in on the loot. Temple gold, stacks of ingots, taken secretly from the Doctrinopolis treasury to a place of hiding when the Infardi invaded. That's what Dower had told him. He'd got the inside track from a dying Ayatani, worth deserting for in Greer's book. He wouldn't be surprised if Dower intended to waste the others once they were home and dry. Greer would be watching his back when the time came. He'd get in first if he had to. For now, though, he knew he was safe. Dower needed him more than any of the others. Vamberfeld was the one he worried about most. Dower had recruited everyone except Sanian and Milo from the hospital, from amongst the injured, and they all had bandaged wounds to prove it. Except Vamberfeld. He was a psych case. Greer knew. The timid behavior, the thousand-meter stare. He'd seen that before, in men who are on the way to snapping. War fever. Greer didn't want to be around when the snap came. He closed the engine cowling.
"She's running. Let's go if we're going."
The company moved back to rejoin the Chimera. For the umpteenth time that day, Corbeck wondered what he had got himself into. Sometimes it felt so decisively right, but the rest of the time the doubts plagued him. He'd broken orders and persuaded 8 other guardsmen to do the same, and now he was heading into enemy country. He wondered what would happen if they got into a situation. Milo was sound and able-bodied, but the Doc and Sanian were non-combatants. Nessa was strapped up with a healing las wound in her belly. Bragg's shoulder was useless. Dower and Derren had chest wounds that slowed them down badly. Greer had a head wound, and Vamberfeld was teetering on the edge of nervous collapse, not to mention his own aching wounds. Hardly the most able and fit fire team in the history of guard actions, nor the best equipped. Each trooper had a las rifle, in Nessa's case a long las sniper model, and Bragg had his big autocannon. They had a box of tube charges, but were otherwise short on ammo. As far as he knew, they had only 6 drums for the cannon. The Chimera had a storm bolter on its pintle, but given its performance so far, Corbeck wasn't sure how much longer it would be before they were all walking. He wondered what Gaunt would do in this situation. He was pretty sure he knew. Have them all shot. Through the trees, thick roadside glades of acetus and slim-trunked viperium, they began to see the outlines of Bavnaga. It was late afternoon. The sun was infernally bright and hot, and the heat haze was distorting every distance. The recon spear had made excellent time, and word on the Vox was that the main convoy was only 70 minutes behind them. McColl pulled them to a halt and headed out into the groves with McVenna to do a little scouting. They crouched in the slanting shadows of the wild fruit trees and panned their magnoculars around. The air was still and breathless, as dry and hot as baked sand. Insects ticked like chronometers in the gorse thickets. McColl compared what he saw with the town plan on his map. Bavnaga was a large place, dominated by a large whitewashed temple with a golden stupa to the east and a massive row of brick-built produce barns to the southwest. Prayer kites and flags dangled limply from the golden dome in the breezeless air. The road they were following entered in the southeastern corner, ran in south of the temple to what looked like a triangular marketplace which roughly denoted the town center, and then appeared again north of large buildings on the far outskirts that McColl took to be machine shops. A street plan of smaller roads radiated out from the market, lined with shops and dwellings.
"Looks quiet,"
said McFenna.
But alive this time. Figures there, in the market.
I see them.
And two up there, on the lower balcony of the temple.
Lookouts.
Yeah. The pair moved forward and down a little, parallel to the highway. Once the road came out of the fruit groves, it was open and unprotected for over 1,500 meters, right down to the edge of the town. Trees had been felled and brush cleared.
They don't want anyone sneaking up on them, do they?
McColl held up his hand, the signal for quiet. They both now detected movement in the trees 20 meters to their right on the road itself. With McVenna a few paces behind him in cover, Laz raised, McColl slid forward silently through the dry undergrowth. He slipped his silver blade from its sheath. The man was watching the road from a small culvert under the trees. His back was to McColl. The vehicles of the recon spear were out of sight beyond the road turn, but he must have heard their engines. Had he sent a signal already, or was he waiting to see what came around the bend? McColl took him out with a fast, sudden lunge. The man didn't have time to realize he was dead. He was dressed in green silk, his filthy skin livid with tattoos. Infadi. McColl checked the corpse and found an old auto rifle but no Vox set. Tucked into a hand-dug hole in the side of the culvert was a round mirror. Simple but effective signaling, perhaps to another invisible spotter down the road. How many others? Had they already rolled in past some? He looked back at the town in time to see sunlight glint and flash off something on the temple balcony. A minute or so later, it repeated. An answer? A question? A routine check? McColl wondered whether to use the mirror or not. He'd tip them off if he got the signal wrong, but would a lack of response be as bad? The flash from the temple came again.
Chief, McVenna hissed over the headset box.
Go. I see flash signals.
On the temple?
No, far side of the road from you, about 30 meters, right where the tree line ends.
McVenna had a better angle. McColl moved back out of the culvert softly and edged down a little way, his stealth cloak pulled around him. He could see the man now, on the far side of the road under a swathe of camo netting. The man was looking up the highway and seemed not to have made out McColl yet. McColl sheathed his blade and took up his las rifle. The sound suppressor was screwed in place. He seldom took it off in country. He waited for the man to shift around and raise his mirror again, and then put a single shot through his ear. The Infadi spotter tumbled back out of sight. The scouts headed back to the recon spear. Cyrus was waiting, with the commander of the other conqueror.
No idea of numbers, but the place is held by the enemy, explained McColl. We picked off a couple of lookouts on the road. They're watching the approach carefully, and they've made the south edge of the town clear. I'd prefer to take the time to disperse my troops into the woods here to clear for other spotters and maybe make a crawl approach after dark, but
I think the clock's against us. They'll notice their spotters are quiet before long, if they haven't already.
We'll have the whole bloody convoy bunching up behind us in less than an hour, said Cyrus.
Maybe that's how to play it, said the other commander, a short man called Farrant or Ferranta. McColl hadn't quite caught it. Wait until the main elements arrive and then just go in, full strength.
It made sense to McColl. They could waste a lot of time here trying to be clever. Maybe this was an occasion where sheer brute force and might were the best course. Simple, direct, emphatic. No messing about.
I'll get on the Vox and run it past the boss, he said, and walked over to his salamander. There was a faint, distant bang, muffled by the dead air of the hot afternoon. A second later, a whooping shriek came down out of the sky.
Incoming!
Cyrus yelled. All the men broke for cover. With a roar, the shell hit the road line 25 meters short of them and blew a screen of trees out onto the track. After a moment, two more exploded in the trees to their left, hurling earth and flames into the cloudless blue. Soil drizzled down over them. Both conquerors came around the salamanders, the Wrath of Padua leading the way. More shells now, detonating all around them. The enemy had either done an excellent job of range-finding or had just got very lucky.
Hold! Cyrus, hold back! McColl yelled into the Vox as his salamander lurched forward.
He had to duck as debris from a perilously close shell rattled across the hull. This was shelling from more than one gun. Multiple points, field guns maybe, large caliber ordnance by the size of the shell strikes.
Where the hell were they hiding a battery of artillery?
Ferrant's conqueror suddenly came apart in a huge fireball. The explosion was so fierce The shockwave punched Bacall off his feet. Splintered armor shards rained down. Keober cried out as one ripped his forehead. The blazing remnants of the Pardis tank filled the center of the road. Turret disintegrated, bodywork fused and twisted, tread segments disengaged and scattered. The Wrath was beyond it, moving down the roadway.
"Enemy armor! Enemy armor!"
Cyrus bawled over the Voxlink. McCall saw them. Two main battle tanks, painted bright lime green, main guns roaring as they tore their way out through the fruit tree stands and onto the road ahead. That was why he'd seen no artillery positions. It wasn't artillery. The Infadi had armored vehicles. Lots of them. Chapter 10. The Battle of Bavnaga. Do not shirk. Do not falter. Give them death in the name of Sabbat. Saint Sabbat. At the gates of Harkalon. Heedless of the 105mm shells tearing into the highway and trees around him, Cyrus confronted the Infadi armor head-on. The Wrath of Padua sped forward with a clank of treads and fired its main gun. The hypervelocity round hit the nearest of the two enemy vehicles, exploding into the rear mantlet of its turret. With such force, the entire turret mount spun round through 210 degrees. The tank clearly retained motive power, because it continued to churn along the road, but its traverse system was crippled, and the turret and weapon swung around slackly with the motion. The Wrath fired again, mere seconds before a shell from the second tank glanced lengthways along its starboard flank. The hit buckled and tore its track guards, and then fragmented off into the trees. The Wrath's second shot had missed. The disarmed Infadi machine was closing to less than 40 meters now, and its hull-mounted las cannon began to spit bolts of blue light at Cyrus's conqueror. The other enemy tank was trying to pull around its wounded colleague for a clearer shot, knocking down a row of saplings and smaller cetus trees as it hauled half its bulk off the highway and through the verge underbrush. Heavy shelling from as-yet unseen Infadi units continued to lacerate the position. With furious lasfire from the injured tank now splashing off the Wrath of Padua's front casing, Cyrus ordered his lair to address the other tank coming around the first. Relaying the gun took a vital second. In that time, the second tank fired again and hit the Wrath squarely. The impact was enough to lurch all 62 tons of armored machine several meters sideways, but it didn't penetrate the 20-centimeter-thick armor skin. Inside, the crew was dazed, and they'd lost most of the forward scopes. Cyrus bellowed to retask, but the tank was now right on them and looming for the kill. A devastating lance of laser fire raked past the Wrath and cut through the assaulting vehicle below the turret. Internally stored munitions went off, and the tank exploded with such force that the main body and track assemblies cartwheeled over in a blistering fireball. The blast wake and shrapnel cleared a semicircle of woodland 20 meters in radius. The destroyer, Grey Venger, had struck. From the open cab of his rapidly reversing salamander, McCall saw the long, low destroyer prowl past, pools of heat discharge spewing from the vent louvres around its massive fixed laser cannon. It nudged aside the burning wreck of Ferrant's dead conqueror and came up alongside the Wrath. But the crew of the Wrath of Padua had recovered their wits and swiftly nailed the remaining aggressor hard at short range, blowing out its port track sections and shunting it away lame with the shell impact. It began to burn. By then, the trio of scout salamanders had reversed far enough to be able to turn. "Break off and retreat," McCall shouted into the Vox. "Fall back to waymark 00.58. Le Guin immediately acknowledged, but McCall got nothing from Cyrus. "Fething idiot wants to stay in the fight," McCall thought. From his machine's tactical auspex, he counted at least 10 good-sized targets moving up towards their position from Bavnaga. But Cyrus suddenly appeared out of the Wrath's top hatch, looking back through the gusting smoke to McCall. The last hit had taken out his Vox system and intercom. McCall made damn sure Cyrus understood his hand signals. The Grey Venger stood its ground and walloped two more incandescent blasts down the road at targets McCall couldn't see. Probably just discouragement tactics, he thought. Who wants to ride an MBT into woodland cover when you know an Imperial destroyer is waiting for you? The Wrath of Padua reversed hard and swung around to follow the salamanders, traversing its turret to the rear to cover their backs. Then, as it too began bravura discouragement shelling, the Venger came about and trundled after them all so fast its hull rocked and rose nose up on its well-sprung torsion bar traction. deafened and a little bloodied, the recon spear made off down the highway, away from the bombardment, which continued for some 15 minutes after they had withdrawn. There was no sign of pursuit. McColl voxed the bad news to Gaunt. Keeping a weather eye on the northern approaches for signs of the enemy, the recon spear waited to rendezvous with the main honor guard strength at waymark 00.58, a west-facing escarpment of grass pasture 15 kilometers south of Bavnaga. The sun was beginning to sink, and the intense heat of the day was dissipating. A southerly was blowing cooler air down from the misty shapes of the sacred hills, which now could be seen rising above the wide green blanket of the rainwoods on the northern horizon. McColl got out of his salamander, passing Bonin, who was field-stitching the gash in Keoba's face, and walked towards the Roth of Padua. He took the time to gaze at the sacred hills, dark uplands 70 kilometers away, then behind them, higher peaks fading to an insubstantial grey in the distance. Behind them, still, about 100 kilometers beyond, the majestic jagged summits of the sacred hills proper, transparent, icy titans with their heads lost in ribbons of cloud, 9,000 meters above sea level. It was quite a prospect. The fact that getting there involved struggling past at least one enemy tank unit dug into their only guaranteed fuel depot, then rainwood jungle, then increasingly high mountains, made it all the more chilling. Thunder, the reveille call of a too-hot day in summer, crackled around the neighboring hills. The taste of rain was a promise on the rising breeze. Swells of grey cloud, as mottled as imperial air camo schemes, rolled in from the north, staining a sky that had otherwise been cloudless and blue since the fogs lifted that morning. Small chelons and goat-like herbivores grazed and ruminated in the lush meadows beyond the raised pasture of the waymark point. Their throat bells clanged dully as they moved. Cyrus and his men were running emergency repairs to the great wounded Roth of Padua. They were joking and laughing with their captain, reveling in the details of their recent combat and the fact they had come away alive. No one spoke of the dead crew. There would be due time for recognition later. McColl felt sure that once the obstacle of Bavnaga was done with, there would be more than one conqueror to mourn. A figure approached him across the wind-shivered grass. McColl knew at once it was the so far unseen Le Guin. He was a short, well-made man in his 30s, dressed in tan pardus fatigues and a fleece-lined leather coat. He unbuttoned his leather skullguard as he approached, unplugging the wire of his headset. His skin was darker than most of the pardus men, his eyes glittering blue.
"Cool head, Sergeant," he said, offering McColl his hand.
"Look mighty tight there for a minute," McColl replied.
"It was, but so are the best fights."
"I thought Cyrus might blow it," McColl ventured. Le Guin smiled.
"Anselm Cyrus is a bravo and a glory hound. He's also the best conqueror boss in the Pardus, except maybe for Wall. They have a rivalry, both multi-aces. But permit Cyrus his heroics. He's the very best."
McColl nodded. "I know similar infantrymen. I thought they'd got him there, though. But for you."
"My greatest pleasure in life is using my girl's main mount to effect. I was just doing my job."
The Grey Venger lay nearby, hull down in a grassy lee, its massive muzzle pointing north up the road. McColl reflected that if he'd ever been schooled in armor, a destroyer would have been his machine of choice. As far as 50-plus tons of rattling armored power could be said to be stealthy, it was a silent predator. A hunter. McColl had a kinship with hunters. He'd been one all his adult life before the guard, and, in truth, he'd been one ever since, too. Some of the grazers in the meadow below suddenly looked up and began to move away west. A minute later, they heard the gathering thunder from the south.
"Here they come," said Le Guin.
The honor guard assembled at the waymark, spreading its strength out in a firm defensive line facing the north. As the tanks took up station, the Hydra batteries behind them, the infantry dismounted and dug in.
"Now we'll see fun, sure as sure,"
Trooper Koo informed Larkin as they took position in the grasses.
"Not too much fun, I hope,"
Larkin mumbled back, test sighting up his long las. As the force secured the position, Gaunt called his operational and section chiefs for a briefing. They assembled around the back of his salamander. Cleopas, Rawn, Collier, Hark, Surgeon Kurth, tank commanders, squad leaders, platoon sergeants. Some brought data slates.
some charts. Most clutched tin cups of fresh brewed caffeine, or smokes.
"Opinions?"
he asked, drawing the briefing to order.
"We've got no more than 4 hours of light left. Half of that will go getting into position,"
Cleopas said.
"I take it we're looking at dawn instead."
"That means we're looking at noon at least to refuel and turn around, provided we can break Bavnaga," replied Rorn. "That's half a day chopped off our timetable just like that."
"So what?"
Cleopas asked cynically.
"Are you saying we rush ahead and hit them up tonight, Major?"
Some of the Pardis laughed.
"Yes,"
Rorn answered coldly, as if it was so obvious Cleopas might be a fool to miss it. "Why lose the daylight we have left? Is there any other way?" "Airstrike," said Commissar Hark. To a man, the tank soldiers moaned.
"Oh, please, this is a prime opportunity to engage with armor,"
said Cyrus.
"Leave this to us."
"I'll tell you what it is, Captain," said Gaunt, darkly. "This is a prime opportunity to discharge a mission for the God Emperor as expediently and efficiently as we can. What it's not is an opportunity to let you heap up glory by forcing a tank fight."
"I don't think that's what Cyrus meant, sir,"
said Cleopas, as Cyrus scowled.
"I think it's exactly what he meant," said Hark, lightly. "Whatever he meant. I've been talking to Navy Strike Command at Ansipar. The air wing is tied up with the evacuation. They wouldn't tell me more than that. We might get an airstrike if we wait 2 days. As Major Rorn pointed out, time is not for wasting. We're going to take Bavnaga ourselves. The hard way."
Cyrus smiled. There was murmuring. Gaunt consulted the assessment reports on slate.
"We know they have at least 10 armor units, non-imperial MBTs."
"At least 10,
repeated Cyrus.
"I doubt they would have fielded their entire complement to chase off a raid."
"Type and capability?"
Gaunt asked, looking up.
"Udeshi-made tanks. Type AT-70s, said Le Guin. "Indifferent performance and slow on the fire rate. 105mm guns as standard. They're common here in this subsector and favored by the arch-enemy." "They've been cranking them out of the manufactories on Urdesh ever since the foe took that world,"
said Latour, another tank officer.
"The Reaver model, by the look of the ones I saw," Le Guin went on. "Promethium guzzlers with cheap armor, and loose in the rear on a turn. Our conquerors outclass them. Unless they have the numbers, of course. From the hammering we got on the road, I'd say they had a minimum of 5 self-propelled guns, too,"
said Cyrus.
"At the very least," said Le Guin. "But there's another thing. They continued to shell the roadway for quite a time after we pulled back. I bet that's because they didn't know we'd gone. They had an efficient string of spotters and lookouts, but my guess is their onboard scanners are very much lower spec than ours. No ore specs, no landscape readers. Until they or their spotters actually see us, they're blind. We, on the other hand..."
"Noted," said Gaunt. "Okay, here's how we're going to play it. Head-on assault following the road line. Tonight. If we think it's dicey leaving it so close to nightfall, you can bet they won't expect it. Armor comes out of the woods and spreads. Infantry behind, supporting..."